Hamdari, who is leading the drills, says his country will not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements or terrorists in the region.
We respect the sovereignty of all countries, including our neighbors, but are strongly against the presence of the Zionist regime as well as the Daesh terrorists.
Iran has long voiced concern over what it calls the presence of Israeli elements and terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists assembled there at the invitation of a regional state at the height of a 2020 conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. Some analysts say the drills send a clear and powerful message to other countries against any acts that challenge Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
This one here in the northwest is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And don't forget, it's been done, because the Azerbaijani themselves have talked about a southern Azerbaijan, referring to the Iranian territories, which are the province of Azerbaijan, as essentially theirs. Now, this is something the Israelis, I'm sure, can stoke up really quite a lot in terms of trying to create division and fragmentation.
Moreover, General Haidari also made it clear that the Islamic Republic will not tolerate any change to the official borders. He stressed that the transit routes in the region should remain safe and secure, and that all the regional countries should respect the flow of trade and energy through their borders. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guard Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's president Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. Iran's foreign ministry, however, reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drills was meant to secure regional peace and security.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S. Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it is not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S. is insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including six children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Just tip of the iceberg on how humiliatingly the Taliban defeated the U.S. in Afghanistan's battlefield. The Pentagon now has finally made admission of its failures, which enabled the Taliban to take over the entire Afghanistan so swiftly.
We need to consider some uncomfortable truths, that we didn't anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha Agreement, and that the Doha Agreement itself had a demoralizing effect on Afghan soldiers. And finally, that we failed to grasp that there was only so much for which and for whom many of the Afghan forces would fight. The fact that the Afghan army that we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise.
If today the world needs to know why the Taliban are back in power, all the world has to do is do a deep analysis of why 300,000 well-equipped Afghan army give up without a fight.
Contrary to what Pentagon admitted before the U.S. Senate Armed Service Committee, as many as 22 Republican senators introduced a bill in the Senate to probe the role of regional countries with particular focus on Pakistan in the military defeat of U.S.-led NATO troops in Afghanistan. The bill proposes sanctions on regional countries, particularly Pakistan and nascent Taliban government in Kabul. After Afghanistan, Pakistan has suffered the most. Tens of thousands of people died. An estimated $250 billion losses occurred to the economy in the long-drawn retaliatory insurgency in Pakistan for supporting a U.S. war on Afghanistan.
The only reason we suffered so much was because we became an ally of the U.S., of the coalition, in the war against Afghanistan, where there were attacks being conducted from Afghan soil into Pakistan. At least there should have been a word of appreciation. But rather than appreciation, imagine how we feel when we are blamed for this, the turn of events in Afghanistan.
Pakistan sounded disappointed with what it called the ungratefulness of the West for ignoring its sacrifices in a war which people here always believed was not their war. Analysts believe that Islamabad is likely to get further closer to China and become part of the efforts to build up a block of regional countries in the event of U.S. economic sanctions on Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It was the biggest state intervention in the UK's labor market since World War II, introduced 18 months ago to help firms weather the economic storm whipped up by the pandemic. Popularly known as the furlough scheme, it's cost a whopping $94 billion. Without it, there are concerns that the job market will be flooded as job seekers need to find employment.
The young people in particular will be not doing well in this, but anybody on the borderline of low-paid jobs or into welfare benefit or an element of welfare benefit in their income, they are going to be hit very, very badly indeed.
Launched in March last year, the scheme was the brainchild of British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, covering 80% of a furloughed employee's wages. When it started, it helped save more than 11 million jobs. 18 months later, it was still supporting well over a million of them. The government is hopeful that the more than a million job vacancies will absorb workers coming off furlough. Critics say the decision to wind up the scheme will only intensify Britain's economic woes.
And there's going to be about 1.6 million people who are going to be unemployed, losing their jobs. And they will not be able to find jobs necessarily in other sectors of the economy. There are several reasons for that. Partly there's a lack of skills matching. And also because the conditions of the virus have taught people how bad so many of the jobs were. They were not full-time jobs. They were temporary, insecure, low-paid jobs. And a lot of people do not want to go back to those situations.
But it's not just the ending of the furlough that is a concern among Britons. A temporary increase in welfare payments, universal credit, and a moratorium on evictions for renters squeezed by the pandemic are also ending in October, at a time when consumers are facing a 12% rise in energy costs.
And all of that happening at a time when the country's economic recovery from COVID-19 is faltering, as announced by the Bank of England's governor just this week. And what that means for the people in Britain is that an autumn storm is on the way. Saeed Purizab, London.
funeral prayers for one of the 8 members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the 8 were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They killed about 8 people, which we are sure that not as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also the same thing yesterday. They carried away the dead bodies. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they described as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid. They paid their salary and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the 8 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Presidents of Russia and Turkey held their face-to-face talks since the beginning of pandemic. After the talks, the two leaders confirmed that the mutual ties developed positively despite some problems.
Our negotiations are not always easy, but with a positive final result, our departments have learned compromises that are beneficial to both sides.
Syria was among the main topics of talks between the two leaders. In Syria, Russia serves as the main supporter of the Syrian government, while Turkey backs anti-government groups. Despite this, the two countries have been cooperating in seeking a political solution in the country.
Peace in the Syrian region depends on Turkish-Russian relations. Our joint steps on the Syrian issue are of great importance. The steps we have already taken were correct and cannot be changed.
Last year, Turkey and Russia reached a ceasefire agreement to put an end to war in Syria's Idlib. Turkey is concerned that an escalation of violence in northern Syria may lead to a new influx of refugees across its borders.
The two sides have to make a balanced relation when it comes to Syria, but it is not an easy task amid plots by the US and its allies. For example, the US did not object to the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Syria through the territory controlled by the Syrian troops, and this was done with an attempt to knock Russia and Turkey head on.
The talks between Erdogan and Putin came after U.S. President Joe Biden refused to grant a one-on-one meeting with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly.
Another pressing issue in Russian-Turkish cooperation is Ankara's purchase of Russian S-400 missile systems. On the eve of his visit to Sochi, Erdogan told reporters that he rejects any foreign pressure regarding this issue and intends to go ahead with his decision to the system. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us. But so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul, a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones.
A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people, rather than affecting the Taliban. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide for the strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond the red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terrents fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Passed since the brutal assassination of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Her widow and advocates are pushing for accountability and action from the Biden administration. Former President Trump's personal defendant, the Saudi Crown Prince, was thought to be behind us, but President Biden had promised to punish the perpetrator. The Biden administration just sufficed to come up with a report on the U.S. intelligence community's assessment of the murder, which said that MBS approved the Operation Istanbul to either capture or kill the Saudi journalist. Let's watch a report.
Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi-born, US-based journalist and outspoken critic of the Saudi government, was assassinated on October the 2nd, 2018. His death shocked the world because he was killed in one of the most brutal and unusual ways possible. On the day of his assassination, Khashoggi walked into the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul. Khashoggi never came out of the building.
Where is Jamal Khashoggi?
What do we know about really what happened to Jamal Khashoggi?
Turkish police insist that they know what they're looking for.
Well, the Saudis haven't been telling the truth right from the start.
Horrifying accounts have emerged of how the 59-year-old was murdered, who was responsible, and what happened to his remains. After more than 2 weeks of denials, Saudi Arabia eventually admitted that he had been killed in the consulate. The Saudis insisted that he was murdered in a rogue operation. But the international community demanded answers. Turkish investigators said video and audio recordings prove that he was tortured, killed, and dismembered. Further findings revealed that the gruesome murder was ordered by the highest level of the Saudi leadership. Later on, the United Nations confirmed it as well.
I have insisted that the killing of Mr. Khashoggi is a state killing. It is not a killing by rogue officials.
The Saudi government said 11 people had been indicted in connection with Khashoggi's killing, but a report by the CIA determined that the killing was ordered by no other than Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudis later claimed that what happened to Khashoggi was the result of a failed interrogation. Ample evidence provided by different intelligence agencies have proved otherwise. Khashoggi was once close to the Al Saud royal family and served as an advisor to the regime, but later he fell sharply out of favor with Riyadh. In September 2017, he left the kingdom and went into self-imposed exile in the US. In his Washington Post columns, Khashoggi was highly critical of the Saudi crown prince. The case of Khashoggi has come to be known as one of the most outrageous examples of how a government targets its critics. It has also exposed the fact that Saudi Arabia's Western allies are absolutely unwilling to risk their ties and trade deals by taking a firm stance against gross human rights violations committed by Riyadh.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. Human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik is joining us out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Historian and journalist Bryce Junkers is also joining us from Hassel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me start with Daniel. 3 years ago today, Daniel, Washington Post Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed. CIA concluded that MBS had ordered the killing. The Saudi crown prince has not faced any punishment yet. Why is that?
Well, for the main reason being that the U.S. values Saudi Arabia as a political and military ally, in the Middle East, and it values it more than human rights. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It values it more than the human rights of Saudis. You know, Saudi Arabia is a very repressive regime vis-a-vis its own people. And, of course, Saudi Arabia is a brutal regime towards its neighbors like Yemen and Syria. And so this does not surprise me at all. You know, while Biden promised that he would get justice for Khashoggi, he also said he was going to stop supporting Saudi Arabia's brutal war in Yemen, which he hasn't done that either. So it's business as usual. It's disappointing, but not surprising.
Okay, Brecht, Saudi Arabia is notorious for stifling voice of dissent, no matter who they could be. They even do that to their own members' royal family, like MBS had his own uncle, Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, who was former interior minister, and others arrested a few years ago. So sky seems to be the limit when it comes to oppression in the House of Saud, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, as was mentioned already, Saudi Arabia, as ever since its foundation, with the support of the United Kingdom back then, been a highly oppressive, highly repressive regime that, of course, drapes itself in an Islamic flag and calls itself the custodian of the holy mosques of Mecca and Medina, but in reality is a almost medieval style brutal government system in which thrives on oppression and on bloodshed, and has shown time and again that they are not afraid to take lives, to torture, to murder, and even to commit mass murder, as they've been doing in Yemen. But of brutality, this has all kicked into a higher gear ever since MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, has come to de facto power. Of course, he's theoretically still just the crown prince, but in reality, as everyone knows, he is the actual power behind the throne of his father. And behind much of the new system that rules over Saudi Arabia.
Right.
The entire government consists mostly out of his cronies and his yes-men who follow his every command. And we have seen this when he starts imprisoning and even executing members of his own family, members of his own inner circle, when he starts persecuting people that were not even actually opposed to the Saudi monarchy in the past. Most obvious and most famous case in point being Jamal Khashoggi himself, who, let's be honest, was not really a massive dissident. He was not, let's say, an Arab nationalist Republican or one of the members of the Shia resistance in the eastern regions of Saudi Arabia. Not at all. He was a man who had a long history and a long contour of service in service of the Saudi monarchy. He just simply disagreed with the way things were being done under MBS, and that is what cost him his life. So there is definitely, there should not be a shock or should not be a surprise when you see that this man got basically tortured to death and sawn into pieces on diplomatic grounds in a foreign country. This is something that sounds absolutely ridiculous. And it does, unless, of course, you realize that this was Mohammed bin Salman was pulling the rope and who was ordering this. This is exactly, completely according to his modus operandi. This is how this man, unfortunately, who is in charge of one of the biggest economies in the world, this is how this man operates. This is how this man has worked for years.
Now, Daniel, in terms of human rights violations, the Saudis have a long record as well, and that includes repressing the minorities in their own eastern province, like Brecht also rightly mentioned, and also taking the lives of women and children in Yemen, yet they are removed from the UN child killer list. Let's have your comments.
Again, all this is very politicized. What is good for some countries is not good for others. We see, for example, now the ICC has announced in terms of its investigation into human rights abuses during the war in Afghanistan, it is not going to investigate the instigator of the war in Afghanistan, the United States. You know, it appears that the rich and powerful countries are able to evade justice as well as their allies, while, you know, poorer and less powerful countries cannot. You know, I think the other thing that needs to be pointed out, I mean, it's no coincidence that it just came out that the CIA itself, I believe it was now, we learned in 2017, hatched a plan to kidnap and kill Julian Assange, a journalist that has been critical of the United States. And so the killing of Khashoggi is nothing averse even to the United States in terms of what it does. So, again, none of this is surprising, but we see these double standards being applied all the time.
Rich, let's have your comment on that, too. I mean, how could Saudis be removed from that blacklist of the United Nations as child killer state? There are proof, you know, on the ground, and you know what I'm talking about. And the war is still going on.
Yes, it's exactly like has been mentioned. The United Nations, for all the good it has done and for all the lofty promise that it held and still holds, of course, it has there have to be some sort of a national discussion, negotiation, and a way in which we try to prevent war. So obviously that there needs to be something like that in a modern day and age. But the United Nations was constructed originally and still maintains that premise, was constructed in on a very from the very start, when it began, of course, with appointing the permanent five members, when it began to give veto powers to the superpowers, which can override the democratic process of this international body. Obviously, we have had a slight democratization by the fact that now also countries that, like China, like Russia, of course, that are not walking necessarily the line, have a veto power as well, but this by itself does not make it more democratic. Now, when it comes to the ICC or the International Court of Justice, because the ICC, the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, and when it comes to things such as the list of violators of children's rights, these are all matters that are very often discussed with focus groups, with lobby groups, and there is always a lot of pressure by the superpowers and a lot of money going on in circles such as this, unfortunately. And this is why we see this this terrible perversion of justice taking place over and over again. It is surprising to me that after the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi that the United States has allowed the truth to even come out at all. There was originally, Donald Trump, of course, has been defending Saudi Arabia for a long time. But in my opinion, the fact that we even know, us as the non-initiated ones, so assured that Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in the consulate, that by itself was a little bit, I think, of a threat that the United States released, because at that point, and even still now a bit, they have been afraid for quite a while now that they might be losing control of MBS, that MBS might be a little bit too much a little bit too much. Have already kind of made him lose face to the international community, but that's unfortunately that's where it stops. The United States will not go further yet. MBS is not yet one of those puppet rulers that the United States is willing to drop, like they have done, for example, with Saddam Hussein at a certain point, and where they dropped him completely. MBS is not at that point yet because he still toes the line of U.S. imperialism, but because he tried to go a little bit too far in terms of what the United States wanted to allow. They allowed the CIA to leak these reports to confirm that, you know, MBS was behind it. But at this point, we see it's been 3 years to actually prosecute them for it. They have kind of hit him on the fingers a bit and said, you know, you have to watch out with what you're doing. But they are still shielding him from any actual physical repercussions and any actual punishment for the crimes that he has committed so far.
Okay. Now, Daniel, let's turn to the U.S. As a candidate ahead of the Democratic primaries in late 2019, in front of a large crowd of people, Joe Biden said, and I'm quoting it, that Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered, and I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. Almost 2 years ago, he was asked if he would punish senior Saudi leaders for the killing of Khashoggi, and he said yes, he would, and that the Saudis must pay the price. Yes, Saudis are paying the price, but they're paying the price of the U.S.-made weaponry they're using in Yemen.
Yeah, well, again, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think Biden during the campaign said a lot of things that he didn't mean and that he ended up retracting. later. In this case, he knew he had to say something like that. He had to distinguish himself from Trump, trying to portray himself as somehow more committed to human rights. But I'm sure once he became president, people sat him down from the defense industry and said, you know, Saudi Arabia's Arabia is worth billions of dollars to the defense industry in terms of arms sales. And, you know, got him straight that he would not be able to go after Saudi Arabia for Khashoggi or to end the U.S. support on the Saudi war in Yemen, which, again, Biden had promised to do. So we see the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia to be pretty much seamless, regardless of who's in power. And let's remember, of course, in terms of the war in Yemen, that Obama began the support of the Saudi war in Yemen in 2015 when Joe Biden was vice president.
Right. Brecht, let's draw this comparison one more time. You know, former President Trump did openly support MBS and U.S. ties with Saudis at any price. But what about President Biden? He acts differently. He did not meet MBS personally. He had somebody else, security advisor, to meet him. But what's the outcome? What difference does it make? The outcome is that justice is not served. The U.S. is still selling arms to the Saudis and all that.
Yeah, the game of, for them, it's a game of optics. It's a game of propagandistic outlook. You need, for the United States system to survive, you need a form of discussion and, of course, a few points of diversion of divergence and a point of bickering between Republicans and Democrats on matters that, at the end of the day, are quite unimportant and don't touch the fundamental principles. We've seen that over and over again. The Democrats, they try to appeal to the more liberal-minded, the more quote-unquote progressive-minded people, whereas the Republicans try to appeal to the war hawks and the evangelical Zionists that exist, unfortunately, quite a lot in the United States. And that is what they've been playing at. Yeah, Joe Biden, he will say, you know, I have done something already. I don't meet with MBS personally. Does it matter at the end of the day? Of course not. But that's why Agnes Callamard, the former UN rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, she mentioned, she said, at the end of the day, nothing has fundamentally changed. The only thing that is different now is that the United States has condemned in words what has happened and said, you know, this is not proper. But when then the matter came on to put personal sanctions against MBS, personal sanctions, which is a very popular thing to do in the United States, they've been sanctioning hundreds of people over the past couple of years, the United States immediately said, no, we want to recalibrate, they use the term, recalibrate our relations with Riyadh. We don't want to rupture it. So in reality, what does that mean? That means absolutely nothing will fundamentally change. And this is that game that I've been playing for decades. Indeed, as has been said by Daniel, that the Democrats were involved in supporting the war in Yemen in the first place. Yes, the Republicans under Trump, they might have supported that war even more vigorously, and now Biden is trying to reel back the amount of support they want to give. They do the same thing with the Zionist entity all the time. Yes, Donald Trump has moved the capital, the embassy to Jerusalem, whereas Obama criticized, officially criticized, the West Bank settlement that Benjamin Netanyahu was doing. Did Obama actually do anything against Israel?
No.
Of course not. This is purely palaver. This is purely just talk and purely window dressing that they've been trying to do. And this is what we're seeing now as well.
Exactly. Now, Daniel, let's take a look at it in a different way. Also, Khashoggi maybe is not American citizen. What about 9/11 attacks in which lots of Americans lost their lives? We have this listed active report coming out under the Biden administration. And families of victims are asking, you know, for this. But still, you see that the Saudis are just there, and it's proven fact that the Saudis did play a role in that.
Yes, and even though that's true, and even in the face of these newly released documents, the U.S. press has done all it can to downplay the Saudi role in the 9/11 attacks. We know the 15 of the 19 attackers were from Saudi Arabia. We now know, and have known for some time, that Saudi diplomats played some role in supporting the attackers, as you say. And yes, thousands of Americans lost their lives. And yet Saudi Arabia was never punished in any way for this. In fact, we know that when George Bush canceled all flights, he grounded all flights in the United States after 9/11, at the same time he was flying out the family of bin Laden out of the country. So Saudi Arabia has not only not been punished by the U.S. for 9/11, it seems to have been rewarded for it, and that is quite shocking.
Presh, former U.N. Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings and current Secretary General of Amnesty International, Agnes Callamard, you just mentioned, she's expressed disappointment in the Biden administration. She says that that's the U.S. authorities, have to be careful about their pretense of being concerned with human rights and democracy. Pretense of human rights. Spot on, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, she mentions, she says it in the typical careful language of a diplomat, but in reality, you can see it seep through, of course, the disappointment and the anger that is in her words and that she speaks here. And I think this is absolutely warranted. Mm-hmm. We've been, when you analyze matters that are happening, especially in West Asia, especially in the wars involving the United States, everything is so... It's so hypocritical. All the claims that the United States have done, the claims that they fight for human rights, that they fight for democracy, that even the claim that they are defending themselves against some sort of unknown international terrorist enemy, these are all lies. And everything is a very almost Orwellian way of speaking that the United States has been using for the past 20 years at least, because this. This is indeed, like Ms. Callamard said very aptly, just a pretense. They claim that they are looking out for human rights, but they're cozying up to the most rabid violators of human rights in the entire world. In fact, they're not just cozying up to them, they're actively helping them survive. Donald Trump said very correctly at a certain point, which I think might have been a Freudian slip on his behalf, in which he said that Saudi Arabia would not survive for just even for weeks if the United States were to withdraw
supporting them,
the support. They don't have the popular support amongst the people to keep this kingdom intact. So this is all part of a massive propaganda stunt that unfortunately still way too many people are falling for.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this episode of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh and historian journalist Presh Junkers in Hasselt. I've been your host, Behrouz Medev.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At a recent panel, UN officials condemned vaccine apartheid, rising food insecurity, and other markets of inequality that have been exacerbated by the pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, UN Experts Denounce Truly Shocking Magnitude of Inequality Revealed by Pandemic. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. United Nations human rights officials recently decried the truly shocking levels of inequality that have been exposed and exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. from the unequal availability of vaccines to increases in food and housing insecurity across the globe. With 78% of vaccine doses administered in wealthy and upper middle income countries and fewer than 1% distributed in the global south, one international expert said at a meeting of the UN Human Rights Council that the impact of COVID-19 was determined less by biological factors and determined more by structural and socioeconomic inequalities, systematic racism and discrimination. Vaccine nationalism and profiteering around supply and demand approaches to vaccine production and distribution is a human rights violation and abuse being committed by states and businesses alike. Dr. Taleng Mofokeng, a special rapporteur on the right to physical and mental health, told the council, according to a UN report on the meeting. The inequality of the vaccine rollout has been perpetuated by policy choices in the wealthiest countries in the world, including Germany and the UK, where officials have not expressed support for waiving patent protections for COVID-19 immunizations. States must act together in solidarity to fairly distribute vaccines and help each other combat the impacts of COVID-19, said Michelle Bachelet, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. The crisis of vaccine inequity continues to drive deeper divides into the heart of the international community, she added, with countries including Congo, Haiti, and South Sudan among the least vaccinated. Data suggests that most people in the poorest countries will need to wait another 2 years before they are vaccinated against COVID-19, said Mofokeng. Bachelet also said the pandemic has exposed people around the world to economic and social shock, with as many as 124 million people pushed into extreme poverty since the worldwide public health crisis began in 2020. The meeting came 2 months after an Oxfam report revealed that more than 500,000 people in some of the poorest countries in the world are facing famine-like conditions, an increase of 500% since the pandemic started, as Common Dreams reported in July. Bachelet noted at a recent panel that according to the Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, the number of people living with food insecurity had risen by 318 million. Amounting to an unprecedented 2.38 billion people. The level of economic inequality facing countries around the world quickly became apparent when the pandemic began. Economist and Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz told the panel, noting that the coronavirus has not been an equal opportunity virus. It has had a devastating effect on the bottom parts of the economy, of the society. Most of them have been able to carry on continuing their jobs on Zoom, continuing their incomes almost without interruption. That dynamic has been apparent in the United States, with studies showing since the pandemic began that many of the approximately 50 million frontline essential workers have faced heightened COVID-19 transmission risk at work. According to a report released last month by the Institute for Policy Studies, U.S. billionaires have seen their wealth collectively grow by $1.8 trillion, or 62% since March 2020. Bachelet reiterated a call that's been heard for months from rights advocates for a pandemic recovery that is built on the bedrock of human rights and in meaningful consultation with civil society. There must be steps to uphold universal health care, universal social protections, and other fundamental rights to protect societies from harm and make all communities more resilient, said the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.